Well, thank you all very much for coming. The title for tonight's discussion is Does the Arab Spring Need a Summer of Love? And perhaps to just frame that in a slightly different way, it's obvious that the Middle East is in the throes of a huge political upheaval at the moment, one which is probably going to take years, and one which is affecting all the Arab countries to some extent, including those which haven't actually seen uprisings. So the question really is, with all this political change going on, whether there's any likelihood of it changing people's attitudes to sex, gender, sexuality, and so on. I'm Brian Whittaker. I was a Middle East editor of the Guardian newspaper, and I've written a couple of books which are in this sort of territory. One, What's Really Wrong with the Middle East, which basically argues that authoritarian societies are as much of a problem as authoritarian regimes. And the other one, more directly relevant, Unspeakable Love, Gay and Lesbian Life in the Middle East. I have with me here Daniel Newman, who is Professor of Arabic at Durham University. He's translated various works, including a book of Arabic short stories. And you have a new title coming out. Do you want to tell us what that is?
The Sultan's Sex Potions.
Yeah, that's in January.
Indeed, sir.
Yeah. And next, Malu Halassa, who is the co-author of this book, The Secret Life of Syrian Lingerie. So we can explore that shortly. And finally, Shireen Ofeki, you've got your book there, Sex in the City. And, I mean, that is a very detailed study of contemporary Arab attitudes to sex. It's really the only book of its kind, I would say. And it's just been nominated for an award, the Guardian...
Guardian First Book Award.
Great. Okay, so before we get on to the present day, I think we need a little bit of historical background. So if I can start with you, Daniel, the medieval things, and also a bit later. The kind of impression we get from early travellers from Europe to the Middle East, they often depict the region as rather a licentious place, which contrasts with the view a lot of people have of it today. Would you say that was true?
Well, it rather depends what your basis of comparison is, and we all have different benchmarks of licentiousness and debauchery. More importantly, I think we need to consider the kinds of people who went, who came from a particular culture where there was a very restrictive view of sexuality, which, of course, was driven by views of Christianity on sexuality, which go back, of course, many, many centuries. The views that that we have today, still to a large degree, and you're right, it's not something that we've overcome, is due to a number of what some people might call iconic works. But of course, the name Richard Burton is one that inevitably one has to mention. Now, the reason for that, I think, we can identify a number of factors, things that these travellers saw or thought they saw. And we have, for instance, the views on homosexuality, male homosexuality in the Middle East, segregation of women, the harem, of course, which was a major driver, and polygamy. And it's ironic that when it comes to women, these travellers bought into an idea which existed or has existed in the Middle Eastern culture for many centuries and still true today to some degree, of women being these very active sexual beings, devilishly active sexual beings, and when men are faced with this sexual being, they are too weak to resist them. And so this is then viewed as a reason why they have to be covered. Now, the harem, of course, is something that spoke to the imagination of these people, and of course their target readership, because it fed into this image of a very ribald, very licentious society. And when it comes to male homosexuality, the same thing. They were faced with a view of sexuality, and I object to the use of the word licentious. I prefer to use the word positive, a positive view of sexuality which has perdured in the course of Islamic history. But that doesn't mean, and for instance, obviously Richard Burton referred to poetry, the great Abbasid poets, Abu Nawas, Bashar ibn Burd, and so on. And of course, the object of desire in classical poetry that is often a man, or at least grammatically gendered as a man. But in Arab Arabic literature, there was a clear distinction. There was, on the one hand, the poet who could write about, you know, love for a boy, but to link that to this idea of rampant homosexuality that was going on, I think was quite false, even at the time.
And I think there's probably a similar question to be asked about Islam, really, because I get the picture that Islam has often been less prudish about sex than Christianity. For example, you find various ayatollahs giving instructions about discussing things like anal sex and so on in some detail. Would you say that's a fair reason at that point?
Yes, although once again, I don't like these terms, prudish, because they are very much part of what we might call a Eurocentrist discourse. And I think, you know, Foucault has already, you know, demonstrated quite eloquently, you know, the problem with this kind of universalist or essentialist view. Now, of course, the problem in Christianity was that any kind of non-reproductive sex was sinful, but to the extent that even enjoying reproductive sex was sinful. It was a chore. You know, oh, very well, I've got to do it for God, that sort of thing. Now, in Islam, we're fortunate to have many, many sources. There's both religious and literary. Religious, there are numerous hadith, so sayings of the Prophet Muhammad, that underscore the importance of enjoying sexuality, which is viewed as an integral part of human behavior. Without any kind of moralistic view. Secondly, we also have an idea about prevailing attitudes through this huge body of erotic stroke erotological literature. Eroticism is everywhere. You know, it's of course in sort of high literature, but it's very much, and if we talk about an insight into how sexuality was experienced, we need to look at these erotological works, and they were written by predominantly physicians. Interestingly enough, you know, you had Arabs, you had Persians, you had Christians, Jews, Muslims. They were all writing about it. In fact, the earliest extant sources that we have were written by Christians. The great translator, Hunayn ibn Ishaq, who translated many Greek works into Arabic, he was one of the first to write a book on coitus, ba. Now, the view that emerges is one of almost a detached description and even recommendations as to how to improve your sex life. And that, of course, where the aphrodisiacs, or the Sultan's sex post, of course, a book about aphrodisiacs. now, it, of course, it, it's viewed very much within a phallocentric, to use a kind of buzzword, view of sexuality. And alongside these physicians, we have some other scholars. I mean, they were all, you know, polymaths. You have people who were mineralogists or botanists, and they also wrote a little book on how to improve your sex life. We also have great religious scholars, and one name that I must mention, of course, is the 15th century Egyptian faqih, jurisprudent, Suyuti, who holds the record with a vast number, 23 known works on erotology, dealing with all aspects. And the lack of any kind of moralistic view also comes through the way in which all sexual activities, all sexual practices are dealt with evenly. And it cuts across everything. We have bestiality, we have sadomasochism, and everything in between or next to it. So the idea that, you know, so if we look at it from the point of view of Puritan or not Puritan, I think we're missing the point, because we're trying to evaluate something that is culturally different and, of course, also dates back to another period in time.
Coming on to the question of links between sex and politics, do you see any historical period where attitudes towards sex were noticeably influenced by the politics of the time? Can you think of any examples?
That's a tricky point. The corpus of erotological books spans essentially 10 centuries. The earliest works were written in the early 9th century. And the last one was written, the last one that we know of, was written in the 19th century, because, you know, almost every month, you know, it is possible to discover some new manuscript somewhere, because they're not always catalogued, they're held in private collections, so on. I think that the only dramatic break up to the 19th century, because up until then, I don't believe there was any real break in how people viewed sexuality any differently from from how they viewed it in the 9th century. I think the real break came in the 19th century, and this was not a homegrown break. This was imported by foreigners, and missionaries, both Protestant and Catholic, played a huge part. So essentially in the 19th century, elements of Victorian morality, Christian/Victorian morality, are imported into native Muslim societies, and rulers then try to accommodate that. For instance, we have Muhammad Ali, who then introduced a law against transvestites. He closes down a couple of brothels. Then, of course, in the 20th century, it's an entirely different story altogether. But that's one that will be picked up by Shireen, of course.
Yeah, maybe I should just come to you, Shireen, on this, because we had a conversation before about how these ideas came into the Middle East, more conservative ideas about sexuality. And you said some people had kind of been looking at the reasons for the success of Europe.
Yeah, I mean, as Daniel says, it's not a coincidence that we see a shutting down on discourse around sexuality in the 19th century, when we have sort of waves of European occupation. And certainly a number of historians and social scientists, notably Abdulwahab Bouhdiba, if any of you are familiar with his book Sexuality in Islam, certainly he talks about the fact that the shutting down is part and parcel of a sense of inferiority that Arabs have. There's a phrase that describes this in Egyptian Arabic. It's audit al-khawaga. So it's like a complex of inferiority to the foreigner. And some people certainly started asking, why have we fallen under European subjugation? Is it because we are, you know, frankly sexually depraved as the outsiders see us? And what's interesting is that this discourse gets picked up by the early groups, what we now call Islamic fundamentalism, and in particular the Ikhwan Muslimin, the Muslim Brotherhood. And one sees, certainly in some of the writings of Hassan al-Banna, asking why are we colonized by the British? Is it because we are effectively debauched, and in particular homosexuality, and we don't keep women in their place, and they're out, and they're being free, et cetera, et cetera? So you see this being incorporated. What I think is interesting, and certainly the point that has been made, is that when the Arabs were at the zenith of civilization in terms of science and technology and religious thinking, they were also extremely open in the way they spoke and wrote about sex. And the question is the closing around sex that we see today, is that part and parcel of a broader shutting down in terms of politics and economics and cultural thought? And if you turn that on its head, if we are indeed entering a period of transition, will opening up in these other domains, what will that mean for our sexual lives and our personal lives? And they are connected. And that's what I argue in my book.
Okay. Well, we can have some more of that later. Malou, your book on Syrian underwear, I suppose the first question to ask about it is why you did it, and secondly, what you found out.
Okay, well, what I think that in the early 2000s, there wasn't, just to explain some of the context around the beginning of the book, is that there was the emergence in the Middle East of new curators who were looking at art and visual culture in the region. And Syrian lingerie also sort of came out of that impetus, is that Rana Salam, who's my co-editor on the book, is an artist and a Lebanese graphic designer. And she had been walking in Souq al-Hamadiya in Damascus and saw that there was a wealth of different kinds of sexy lingerie styles. Now, Syria is known as they are the Chinese manufacturers of the Middle East. They make a lot of cheap clothing that's sold region-wide, or this is before the conflict. And so Rana, when she saw that the various kinds of lingerie styles I don't know if you're familiar with Syrian racy lingerie. Have you seen it? Like, there would be mobile phone thongs, you know, with... Yes, the mobile phone thongs.
Tell about the old
thongs. Oh, also there are, you know, bras and knickers that would play music. And when you press them. Because they use a Chinese chip. So the Syrians are very adept at these are photographs of Eastern European lingerie models. So it was a whole fashion culture. You had people designing the lingerie, people photographing it. There are over 200 companies in Damascus. They were very competitive in terms of style. There was also my favorite style is a bra and underwear set that's connected. You clap your hands, it falls off the female. Syrian lingerie is very inventive. But Syria also has a cotton lingerie industry. It also has a women's ready-to-wear. It's also known for its suits. So you can understand sexy lingerie within the context. So Rana saw it as a fashion culture, and this was at a time when people were really thinking, or I was thinking about the Arab street. At that time, in the early 2000s, to be a person of substance, to be a public intellectual, you had to write and talk in a very formalized Arabic. Street culture wasn't something that a lot of people were looking at. And so we really wanted to look at lingerie as a prism through which to look at attitudes within the Arab street and also to look at very populist culture. So that's sort of the impetus behind the book. And what we found out is that it is a fashion culture, that that fashion under dictatorship, that fashion can be formed by living or being created under a dictatorship. Also, it was very interesting that Syria did not really have a long tradition of sexy, racy lingerie. What happened after the Yom Kippur War, there was the Gulf countries invested in Syria as a frontline state against Israel. And two things came out, but one was sexy lingerie, because they'd never had that before, so they started manufacturing it. And also there was a building boom in the major cities. So it was interesting to look at lingerie. And you know, there are many sexy lingerie cultures. In Egypt, they make sexy lingerie. In Malaysia, they make sexy lingerie. I hear there's a version of it being sold in Gaza, in the Gaza Strip. So it's interesting to look at these lingerie cultures and see what they say about the society that they're made in.
I was reading one of your articles in The Independent. You made a rather interesting point there. You said that while this kind of lingerie can be seen as evidence of sexual liberation, it's also a sign of women's insecurity, and in a way it perhaps has almost a moral purpose, because it's to discourage husbands from chasing after other women.
Those observations really came from the interviews that we had with women in the book, that we would have instances of women telling us stories that, you know, that they would decide, one woman in particular, she was a cleaner, she decided that she wanted to have sex with her husband. So she waited naked on the bed, wearing the mobile phone thong, and then she would yell out to her husband, you know, ring, 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 who's going to answer the phone? Or, you know, there would be stories of that, women telling us how they would use the lingerie. And then there were also these other stories that women would talk about, that they would go and use the lingerie, or they wanted to have the lingerie, or they explored their sex life through the lingerie with their husbands because they didn't want them to go to prostitutes. Because it did seem that prostitution, with the civil war in Lebanon, Damascus also rose as a sex capital. So that there was a lot of prostitution, whether we're talking about Eastern European women who were modeling the lingerie in pictures that were totally not salacious, no titillation, just smiling as if they were, you know, going to the seaside or something. But also there was Arab prostitution as well. And what was very interesting, when Rana and I were spending time in the factories, we were interviewing the lingerie company proprietors, the designers, the women who worked, the women who sewed, is that we saw that after we'd have these interviews about design or textiles or manufacturing, usually the men who owned the companies would invite us to stay for coffee and tea, and we would talk about pornography on the internet, pornography in prostitution in Damascus. So it was really through lingerie you could see a wide range of what was happening in Syria at that time, the sexual mores. But this is really before the conflict.
Yes, and so I mean, now we have the conflict, and obviously the rise of a lot of Islamist groups as well. Do you see things changing in the future? I mean, it's obviously a very confused situation.
It's a confused situation. It's a complex situation. Syrian lingerie is still being sold. Racing lingerie is still being sold in the souks. It's still there. I think that Syria has always had its own version of Islam. The men, mainly men, and the families that are making the lingerie, they're observant families. They're conservative Muslims. They're making this lingerie ostensibly for the first wedding night. You know, that a young woman and man were getting together. It was to break the ice. It was really for that. It was rites of passage for a young woman from being a virgin into respectable married life. But I think that Syria has always had its own attitudes. I mean, and also Syrian sexual humor is quite amazing too. And sexual humor would be used as a way of saying those things that you couldn't say in public. But you couldn't say maybe officially in public, but you could say in private. So I think that when al-Nusra Front goes to Souk al-Hamadiyya or to the Souk in what's left of the souk in Aleppo, they are going to see the lingerie on sale. And I don't think those families are going to stop selling lingerie. It wasn't, before the conflict, very lucrative. We could tell that these small companies had grown much larger, and they were exporting all over the region.
Okay, Shireen, you say in your book, the only widely accepted, socially acknowledged context for sex in Arab societies is state-registered, family-approved, religiously sanctioned matrimony. And you also point out that increasing numbers of Arabs find it difficult to fit into this mould, whether they're single mothers, youngsters who can't afford to get married, gay people or what. Do you think this is actually the central core of the problem.
So which problem? There are so many of them in the region these days.
The only widely accepted, socially acknowledged context for sex is approved matrimony.
The reason I wrote this book in the first place was knowing the history of the region, and not just the history that Daniel has explored, but the history of my own family. My father and even my grandmother, who came from a village in the Delta, who used to have these incredibly frank sayings about sex, many of which weave their way through the book. The most memorable was, as long as it's away from my ass, I don't care. In Arabic, Madame Bayid and Tizi Khalas. And the ass they're talking about is not the village donkey. And that there seemed to have been a more open discourse around sex, which has narrowed, and certainly since the late 1970s. And it is absolutely the case now that the only accepted context to talk about sex, to even contemplate sexual activity, is marriage. And the difficulty that is being faced is, as you know, the great religions of the region exhort us to remain chaste before marriage. For example, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, suggested that if a young man could not marry, he should fast until he could. But the problem is that we have an age of marriage in many countries, particularly in North Africa, which now exceeds 30s for men. The Prophet Muhammad was not talking about fasting until your 30s. And the question is, what are you going to do? This is not stopping young people from having sex. What it is, however, is driving it underground at a time when you don't face up to the realities of sex, a lot of problems come between the appearance that we don't want to talk about it and the reality that we are doing it. And just to give you one example of this, so getting a handle on youth sexuality is very hard in the Arab region. In many cases, governments will not allow you to ask questions about what young people are doing before marriage. But where you can ask those questions, there's a very interesting pattern which emerges, in which upwards of about 30%, rising to about 80% of young men will say that they are having relations before marriage. But interestingly, almost across the board, 80% of young women will say they are not having sex before marriage. You do the math. This is a difficulty that in the reluctance to acknowledge any other context, many sort of necessary elements of achieving sexual rights, and by that I mean your right to have a happy and pleasurable and satisfying sexual life free of violence, discrimination, and coercion, much of that is getting brushed under the table. So sexuality education, for example. No, we can't possibly offer this in the schools, we say, in Egypt. We say, thank you, young people of Egypt, for leading us into uprising against the dictator. But Anna, we're not going to give you the information that you could actually lead a responsible sexual life and make choices of your own. There's a real disconnect. We say no to abortion, for example. Although coming back to Daniel's work and looking at the history of Islamic jurisprudence, we have this wide range of possible interpretation around matters in sexual life. So on abortion, for example, there are some schools of jurisprudence which say that it is not permissible under any circumstances, and there are some schools which say, yes, it is permissible under a wide variety of grounds. So the question I ask myself, and I ask in the book, is why do we always gravitate now towards the narrowest interpretation, that frankly the most miserable interpretation, when we could have a much more open space? And that's really the heart of the problem. How have we got to this? How have we boxed ourselves in? And how can we get out of this box? And it doesn't mean selling out to the West. It means rediscovering largely our heritage as Arabs and as Muslims.
There's a kind of obsession with religiosity among some people, and that the more strictly you interpret things, the more you can feel that you're holy. Is that a kind of explanation for some of it?
If you look at conservatives, religious conservatives anywhere in the world, you find that they use sex wrapped up in religion as a tool of control. It's extremely powerful. What gives it a particular strength in the Arab region, and of course I'm generalizing across 22 states and 370 million people here, but generally speaking, what gives it force also is it's now defined in opposition to the West. And that, we're closed, we don't want to contemplate any alternative, because that's what Westerners do, and it's a slippery slope to that. And that's why the heritage is so important, not because we go back to some golden age of sexual freedom. I'm not a sexual Salafi here. But what I am saying is that it's important when people want to speak up and question the taboos and that when the opponents, the conservatives, say, you are selling out to the West, we just turn around and say, no, we're not. Know our history. And this is what it is to be true to our history.
So we've heard all these people in Tahrir Square chanting about freedom and dignity and things like that. But so far, those kind of slogans have been applied mainly to overthrowing regimes, though they could quite easily be applied to personal freedoms, personal dignity in the area of sexuality and stuff. But do you feel that the Arab Spring could bring a solution in this area?
It depends on what are we talking about. A solution? No part of the world has reached some sort of sexual nirvana where we have all sexual rights realized. If we're talking about challenging some of these taboos and looking at more open interpretations and greater possibilities, then I think there are greater prospects now than when I started researching this book in 2007, 2008. And to give you one concrete example, when I started this book, in Egypt in particular, no woman would speak out about sexual harassment or sexual violence. No woman would speak out publicly and say, I have been raped. Okay, we fast forward to 2013, and after the horrific events in the organized sexual assaults in Tahrir Square, we do see some women, not all women, some women speaking out, great NGOs working on the ground to try to empower women, to protect them, to help them protect themselves. And what's most interesting is that we find young men standing alongside them, supporting them. So that's movement, certainly, in some aspects of sexual rights. Where we are not, for example, is the freedom to openly express your ideas about sexuality. And the example of this would be the Femen movement. Is everyone here familiar with Femen? Okay, so we've had two notable examples of women who have tried to bring the Femen show back to the Arab region, doing topless protests either online or in the flesh on the streets. And what's interesting is that the reaction to them is not just religious conservatives coming down on them like a ton of bricks, but also political liberals saying, you know what, this is not the revolution we are fighting for. And so my experience in talking to young people is that there is a disconnect between the aspirations that they are working towards on the political sphere and how they see these playing out in private life, and in particular in sexual life. But the question for you, Brian, actually, because you look at a particular group of young people, I mean, do you see that people with alternative sexualities, for want of a better term, do you find that they are making that connection more closely between the personal and the political?
I think they do.
Do you think that has changed dramatically since the uprising?
I wouldn't say that really. The curious thing is that while lesbian and gay people in the Middle East, or at least the activists, seem to have been very supportive of the Arab Spring, they feel that the Arab Spring hasn't really been supportive of them. But at the same time, I think a lot of the processes that have brought the Arab Spring about have also been causing activism over sexuality as well. You know, you think about what I would call globalization of ideas, where with things starting, you know, first of all with sort of fairly cheap air travel, then satellite TV, and obviously now the internet to a much, much greater extent, that people are being exposed to alternative views of the world. Their eyes are being opened to other possibilities that they couldn't conceive of before. So I think there is some kind of movement there, yeah.
My experience in dealing with many of the groups that are working on LGBT rights in the region is that they basically think the Western story of gay rights is basically a non-starter, and that they see the way forward for them in the emerging political order as a very different path. I mean, how do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, I was talking to an Egyptian activist about this once, and he said, you know, we need an Arab way to be gay. And I said, well, what exactly do you mean by that?
Mm.
And he said, well, he didn't, you know, it was a kind of a bit of rhetoric, really. But one of the big debates that you have, and I think it's pretty crucial in this area, is between, say, quietism and activism, or between invisibility and visibility. Because one argument is that gay people in the Middle East are not particularly sought out by the authorities for persecution. You know, the number of prosecutions in the Middle East is far, far lower than what was happening in this country in the 1950s, for example. You know, it's not something that the authorities target particularly, though there are some exceptions to that. So you can argue, okay, if you are gay, you can do things quietly and you'll be all right. And most of the time that is true, though obviously if you get found out, then things go very bad indeed. The counter-argument to that is that you can't have rights without identity and visibility. And I think when you look at it, there is really no alternative to that. So I think it's something which Arab people have to grapple with, that if you want to establish rights, you have to be visible and you have to assert an identity. Otherwise, the authorities can just come up with the usual line, well, we don't have any gay people anyway, so it's not a problem.
But I think you're putting your finger on a really key point, because certainly many of the activists I have spoken with really... I mean, to give you just one concrete example, I spoke with a really articulate woman, a queer activist in Beirut, and I asked her about sort of sexual identity. And she said, Shireen, what are you... Your sexual, you know, sexual rights and sexual identity. And she said, Shireen, what are you talking about, having a sexual identity? I don't even have an individual identity. This individual was in Beirut. So she said, in the government, I am registered as the daughter of my father. And if I were to marry, I would be the wife of my husband. How am I going to have a sexual identity if I don't even have individual and personal rights? And certainly the family, the control of the family and how it dictates so much, and you talk about this in your book, and will continue to do so, certainly until the economic situation changes, for one, really constrains how individuals can talk about practical on the ground change.
Don't you think that's breaking down now?
What? The economics?
The ideas about the family. When I was doing this book, I gave a list of like 10 statements to people I was going to interview and asked them to choose two that they would like to talk about. And everybody I interviewed wanted to talk about the family. And in the end, I was saying to people, okay, you can talk about any of these nine because I've got enough about the family. It is an issue which really, really gets people going, especially the younger Arabs and the lack of independence that they have. And one Iraqi told me this story, which kind of shows how you sort of have to negotiate things. He wanted to do something artistic at university, and obviously that's not a respectable thing for an Arab to study at the university, an Iraqi Arab. And you know what parents expect to study is medicine or engineering. And so there was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing about this. And then in the end, they found an architecture course which was in an engineering faculty in a university. Mm-hmm. And so he was able to do something a bit artistic, which was architecture, but his parents would say he was in the engineering faculty.
But that actually points to a really interesting phenomenon, which is in both in sex but more broadly in Arab society, is that change doesn't come through confrontation. It comes through this very quiet process of negotiation. And it's a very gradual process. So we're definitely not talking about revolution. We're not talking about political revolution. I mean, speaking from Egypt, we've been through this upheaval, and you know, where are we right now? But if it's not happening in politics, then that dramatic break certainly doesn't happen in sexual life. But I would argue, although young people may be chafing against the family constraints, until we have governments which both recognize and respect individual rights. Until you can get things done not based on wasta on your or masobeya on your family connections, until I can get a job as a young person that actually allows me to make enough money, and if I'm a man to get married and move out, my family's still going to call the shots for the foreseeable future, whether I like it or not.
And of course, if you look at the list of the Kuwaiti cabinet ministers or the Emirati cabinet ministers, you see the same names cropping up time and time again. I think about a third of the Kuwaiti cabinet are all called by the same surname.
Mm. Yes. Daniel, I just had a question for you about historically the treatment of same-sex relations. You said that it was discussed without sort of a moral tint, but my sense in many of these books is that there is a sort of pragmatism that, yes, it is haram, okay, now let's talk about what's really happening. Would that be a clearer way to characterize it?
To a certain degree, and as you know, I mean, even the term homosexual is very problematic if you're dealing with pre-modern periods. Khaled al-Raib wrote a very interesting book. There is no homosexuality in the Arab world before the 20th century. Now, this, of course, has been interpreted saying, well, there's no same-sex relations. Of course there was. But the idea of homosexuality, and incidentally, there is no word in Arabic, classical Arabic, that denotes homosexual. It just does not exist. Yes, there is the word Luti, which comes from the tribe of Lot, you know, who were known sodomites. And there is, of course, the modern term, Mithli, which is basically a calc from Western languages. Now, there was no overarching concept of homosexuality. And the Luti was the active penetrator. Now, when I said that the European travellers, this was one of the things that fed into their Orientalist view of Eastern sexuality, they glossed over this very fundamental difference. On the one hand, you know, we have the poetry, you know, praising boys, which in many cases was a device, and the person could equally have been talking about a girl. And on the other hand, we have the sexual act. Now, the sexual act was severely censured in religion. How exactly it was viewed is also interesting, and even the four major schools of jurisprudence don't agree, but generally it is associated with fornication stroke adultery, zina. It's also interesting that the punishment, when Brian talks about persecution and so on, and we've had cases in Egypt, you know, that famous case with the boat and so on, prior to the 20th century, there was no such prosecution. Because you needed a number of witnesses. They, of course, had to be men. They had to be free men who were present at the act. So we have to distinguish between the religious code, where the act of anal penetration of a man was reprimanded, and on the other hand, social permissibility. And the only time that problems in terms of morality occurred was when somebody crossed the gender divide. How did he do that? Well, by becoming the passive partner in anal intercourse. And this was, and still is, an insult. It is, of course, ubna. And ubna refers to being the passive partner in a homosexual act.
Sorry, just a question, Brian. Do you find that distinction even today?
I think I'd like to make a distinction really between kind of social attitudes and religious attitudes, because we're dealing with a very sort of patriarchal society, and a man who plays the female role, if you like to put that, in a sexual act is seen to some extent as sort of a traitor to his gender and all that sort of thing. Now, the issue about having sex is that, as far as I understand it, in Islam it needs to happen within some sort of contractual arrangement. which can be marriage, or it can be a mutter marriage, or these are visitor marriages and that sort of thing. But presumably the idea going back is that that avoids problems over disputes over inheritance and that sort of thing if a baby results. So if you are going to have male and female sex, then there are various legal devices which can legitimise it. And of course, you're allowed to marry more than one woman. But there is no comparable arrangement at present for people of the same gender. And so one or two Muslims have actually argued that the idea of gay marriage and that sort of thing would be a way of getting around some of the religious problems.
Yes, I haven't heard those arguments advanced in the Arab
region. That's a fairly radical sort of view. But,
Just a question for you, Mally, just speaking up on Daniel and all this great corpus of writing and expressing ideas. And these books more or less circulated in the public domain. But today it seems to me that one of our problems in the region is that the only time we can ever talk about sex in the public context is when it is a catastrophe or a disaster or a scandal. And that ability to talk about sex as a source of creativity and well-being, which our ancestors celebrated, long gone. You've been looking at graphic artists in Syria. Do you find that there's a new generation that's sort of
It's interesting that you're talking about we're trying to explore the connection between sexual attitudes and politics. I mean, when you look at Syria, it's a society that's completely been destroyed and falling apart. And what I've found in talking to activists is that on one hand, there's a group of people who've become more religious and they've retreated from society, and then there are all these other people who are very much active, creative, engaged, whether they're doing artwork, filming, whether they're part of these new photographic collectives that are documenting the conflict. I mean, across the board, and those people that I'm talking to, if they were married before, their marriages have broken up, there is more casual sex, I wouldn't call it a summer of love, but there's been some sort of liberation in terms of sexual mores coming from observant, traditional Muslim families. But I think that has to do with I think that such high levels of violence in a place accelerate society, and that all those, the tradition, the stranglehold of the family, it all falls away. And I mean, that's why I was very interested to see sort of the sexual side of Damascus before the conflict in relationship to what happened in Beirut, because Beirut was, at one time the sex capital of that, or the sex city of that region, so that these things move, that a city becomes sexualized suddenly because there's violence nearby and people have to...
I think maybe we take a few questions now. Yep.
I have a question about why this is very Western-centric view, and it kind of disregards a lot of things that are happening in the Arab world. Take Egypt, for example. You have a whole host of movies starting from the 1990s, Al-Hubba fi Hadabat al-Ahram, Hina Maisara, Rasail al-Bahr, and these are just at the top of my head. They discuss homosexuality, actually a lesbian couple in Rasail al-Bahr. الحب في هذا الأهرام is about عرفي marriages that, they want to get married, they're students, they don't have money, the family doesn't allow it, so they go and marry عرفي. This عرفي issue, it became the solution for the students who wanted to have sex, and it was epitomized in the huge popular scandal of, what was her name, Hind al-Hinawi, who married Ahmad al-Fishawi, this great actor, and she had a child whom he didn't want to acknowledge, and then the Mufti stepped in and ordered the DNA test. So this is talked about, it is known. You had a TV program as early as the 1990s presented by Hiba Qutb, who was a sexual therapist. You had a book published in the Emirates, for crying out loud, in the 2008 by Wadad Luta, who is a... Her work is a marriage counselor in the court, the national court of whatever. So there are so many issues that, it's just the Arab world is repressed. They don't talk about sex. They have sex. They enjoy it. They talk about it. They just, it depends on your data set. How did you select your data set? And why did you omit mentioning things like that? I mean,
yeah, it's all here in the book. But again, all these points that you're raising about the films, for example, again, it's always sex as a problem. And I can tell you, in all the films that touch on homosexuality, for example, there is never a good ending for people who are in same-sex relations. I mean, Amara Yacoubian, for example. We have no broke back mountain in Arabic. And, I mean, I have a chapter here on same-sex relations, and one of the individuals I talk about said, you know, for example, I went to see Amara Yacoubian 5 times, and one of the times I was there, when the homosexual character, sorry, spoiler here for anyone who hasn't seen the movie, when he is stabbed, the woman behind me was saying, Ahsan, Ahsan, you know, fantastic, fantastic. And I looked behind and I saw her, and she was a distant relative of mine. I had had sex with her husband. So, I mean, and it is true, there are these films, absolutely, they're notable, but if you look at the wide trends in Arabic, specifically Egyptian cinema, in cinema nazifa, مثلاً, I mean, clean cinema, the idea to get sex out, these films are notable, but they are exceptional. And again, it is framing sex as a problem. Heba Ott, for example, features in my book, I interviewed her at length, and it was fascinating. Her discourse around sex, she was able to get on television because she talks about sex within the framework of Islam. But when I talked to women in Cairo, for example, and asked them, what do you think of Heba Ott? One woman said to me, you know, essentially, you know, I like Heba Ott, but I could never do what she's talking about because I don't have that freedom within my marriage to ask for my sexual rights. I mean, this woman had the relationship to Heba Ott's program that I have to cooking shows. Great, I would love to be able to do it. I just don't have the skill set. And so the problem is not that we don't talk about sex in Egypt or the wider Arab world. We do. Women are talking to women all the time. Men are talking to men all the time. The difficulty we find is when you bring men and women together, there is a certain reticence which comes in many circles. And I talk about this at length, women's difficulties in expressing their sexual needs and their husbands' frustrations with this. But the biggest problem is when we try to take it public. And so if you want to get sexuality education into schools, the government doesn't want to hear about it. We tried to do a survey around sexual behaviors and attitudes. We were turned down. And we're not talking about an Islamist government that forbade us. We're talking about the Mubarak regime that prevented us. So it's not that we don't talk about sex, but there is an unease. There is a discomfort. And this is not historically as it was even looking back 50 years. And that's the point I'm raising.
Another question?
Yeah. It's actually following on from the same subject. I think the main issue is the hypocrisy between what is acceptable behavior in public and what people understand to be okay, and what actually people live behind their own closed doors. And everybody knows what happens behind those closed doors, except they don't accept it to be acknowledged in public. So as long as it's hidden and nobody sees it, nobody hears about it, there's no scandal in the family, you can do whatever you like, really.
And, I mean, a prime example of that will be these operations to restore people's virginity.
Yeah, of course.
Well, women's virginity, I'm not sure there's one for men.
No.
It's almost like standard procedure now. I mean, there are girls from villages, really poor villages, and you think they would never hear about these things, but no, they go to the big cities, they do what they want, and when it comes to a particular age, they just don't get the stitches, they're fine again.
So can I give you an example of what happens when you have a gap between appearance and reality? I talk about this in the book, and virginity is the quintessential instance of this. So we have HIV in the Arab region. It is serious now. We are one of only 2 parts of the world where HIV is still on the rise and AIDS-related deaths are on the rise. So I was out with a group in Morocco, in Casablanca, one of these really brave NGOs that are trying to make sex safe. And we met two young girls in a bar, and they were turning tricks on the Atlantic Corniche. And the outreach workers said to them, you know, really, you should be using condoms. And the girls said, no, we don't need condoms. There's no chance of us becoming pregnant because we specialize in anal or oral sex because we want to get married and we have to be virgins. And their definition of virginity was a piece of anatomy, an intact hymen, the appearance. as opposed to the reality, which is a state. But it's problematic in our time now, when we have a rising tide of sexual violence, when we have HIV/AIDS and STIs rising, when we have a lot of marital unhappiness, which is increasingly revealed in studies about sexual incompatibility and the inability to talk about these issues. The question is, how do you bring it out into the open in a way that people feel comfortable within the context of, you know, the dominant faith, which is Islam? And that's the real challenge for us.
Daniel, do you got any observations, historically speaking, on that?
Well, you mentioned the word hypocrisy. I'm not sure whether it's always appropriate. Let's just say that there is that contradiction that you mentioned, sort of, you know, social code and what is religiously sanctioned and so on. And in the past as well, things went on in private. It wasn't, although you have these stories about various types of sexual activities and sexual practices, it's not as if, you know, they were practiced in public. I think what, and Shireen's point is, I think, a very good one, very valuable one, which is that at some point there was this split, and it has resulted in this very confused and confusing situation, which is causing a lot of hardship to many people. In the past, it was able to indeed celebrate one's sexuality. And there are many books, I mean, even written by physicians, they will say, well, you know, these are the ways in which you can have good anal intercourse. And, you know, they describe all the positions. And these things can be found in works, you know, from Morocco all the way to the edge of the Arabic-speaking world. In fact, even in the Ottoman Empire, where you have similar erotic manuals and you find common stories. So I think the issue here is, again, that split between what is indeed socially, it was perhaps more socially acceptable. And when it comes to same-sex relations, that's why I made the point that there is no homosexual in the Western sense in the past, is that a man who had anal intercourse with a boy was not a homosexual in the current Western sense, because this person would generally also have sex with women. And indeed, there are many books that describe, for instance, the mufakhara genre, where they talk about preference for this or that. And there's a whole list of things. Why it is better to have sex with a boy because of this. But on the other hand, the vagina is better, provided it's a virgin.
But so, he still prefers, I think, in homosexual relationships, the guy who actually penetrates is not considered to be gay as such.
Absolutely. Yeah. He's just finding a release. And there are even hadiths.
And he's doing what a man normally does.
He's penetrating.
Yeah, that's, which is the man's role. So it's not as kind of frowned upon as their position.
Which is why, can I just add one thing, that the person, the boy that they had sex with, was not viewed in terms of the passive one. That only happens, this ubna business only happens if you're an adult, practically when your beard starts to grow.
It's very Greek.
Yeah.
What happens?
Sorry, yeah.
Yeah, I have a question. You mentioned you spoke to a Beirut activist and she, about identity. That was quite interesting what you said, that she has no identity as an individual woman, so why should she even start thinking about having a sexual identity? Now, we have, in the West, maybe the mechanism for women having an identity that's separate from their family came with the Industrial Revolution and having an economic life of your own. What kind of mechanism possible in the Middle East?
Oh, gosh, if I knew that, I'd probably be running for president of Egypt. I mean, there's so much that needs to change at so many levels, and I'm going to speak specifically about Egypt here. I mean, certainly in terms of women's empowerment, I mean, the laws need to change. I mean, we have deeply unequal laws when it comes to political, economic, and social rights for men and women. But we shouldn't get too hung up on the law, because changing a law is a necessary but not sufficient condition. For example, in Egypt, we have a great law which criminalizes female genital mutilation, and yet 80% of girls aged 15 to 17 are circumcised in flagrant violation of the law. we need changes in education. And to my mind, the key change for empowering women is not happening in the classroom. It's happening in the living room. And it's how mothers are raising their sons. And time and again, when I talk to women in this book, divorced women, for example, who are dealing with the stigma of red mothers, the key point they come back to every time is, I am raising my son differently so that he will look at women differently and he will treat them as equals. And that is the key to women's empowerment in the boardroom, in the parliament, and indeed, you know, potentially in the bedroom. But one of the key changes is women's employment. In Egypt, for example, or actually on average across the Arab region, only 25% of women are working. And if you look across the global south, half of women work. So we have these incredibly high levels of female education. In the Gulf states, for example, there are more women than men in universities in many of the countries. But that's not translating into jobs. And until they have economic empowerment, that involves, you know, very complex laws around inheritance, for example, and whole other issues, but particularly employment, women will find it very hard to have a say and to negotiate both inside and outside the bedroom.
Now, I've talked to Kuwaiti women who said that studying at university is one of the few sort of respectable reasons to leave the house.
Yeah.
And so they carry on studying and they do PhDs and state university absolutely as long as possible.
But one of the difficulties is that we have all these fantastically educated women, but we haven't brought along the men with us. So I've met so many women, and in fact there are a number of research projects now across the Arab region looking at a particular group of women who are highly educated, do have jobs, can't find husbands. Most people desperately want to be inside the citadel. These women can't get in. And it was fascinating, in talking to many of these women, they give you a whole raft of reasons why they can't find a husband. But one woman in Tunisia, a young doctor, she summed it up for me perfectly. She said, you know, the women, we are getting more and more open. But the man, he is still at the prehistoric stage.
Sorry, just about the macho culture within the Arab world, and the religion as well, where, you know, the woman is not allowed the same rights as the male. I mean, how can you change that? How can you tell women, you know, that you have to kind of, you know, take your rights? And why is there this kind of double standard? Men are allowed to do anything they want within the Arab world that women can't. And that leads to the, you know, the secrecy and the hiding things. And a woman is always blamed for things going wrong and not the man. Men get away with murder.
It's a patriarchal. Islam is patriarchal, that's for sure.
Is it very different from the situation we had in Britain?
I was just thinking that, is that we're talking about the Middle East like that. I mean, there are many, on many levels, women in the West don't have equal rights also. You know, I mean, it's there. You could compare and contrast.
You know, historically, I'm not sure that it's very different from what Britain was like maybe 100 years ago.
Yeah. Yes.
But the key about Islam is that there is a whole wide range of interpretation, and as we have moved to
more
conservative,
closed.
Yeah, and you know, the reason we have become more conservative and the rise of Islamic fundamentalism varies from country to country. But in Egypt, for example, you look at it as a response to dictatorship, for example, 60 years.
Kind of conspire.
Yeah, because everyone buys into the patriarchy.
Themselves.
Yeah, but patriarchy isn't just the preserve of men. It's also women who buy into the patriarchy because
yes,
they, in some ways, benefit from it as well.
Right.
And I think it's important to keep in mind that the patriarchy is not great for men unless you're at the very top of that pyramid.
Yeah.
It's hard for young men, for example, who can't get jobs, can't afford to get married, can't move on with their lives. Like that poor man, Bouazizi, who set off the Arab Spring. So the problem.
Yeah, but they turn against the women in love.
But again, it's the interpretations of why are we always moving towards these incredibly narrow, you know, frankly misogynistic interpretations when we could to move towards open ones. And I think in, you know, with the rise and fall of Islamic conservatives, the Islamists in, you know, Egypt and you know imminently in Tunisia, and certainly troubles in Morocco, that I'm hoping that we will start to see questioning about how religion, Islam in particular, is used to suppress women, but also men, quite frankly, men in many circumstances. And I think we're already starting to see that discussion happening, but it's going to take a very long time. We didn't get into this mess overnight. It took us 60 years in Egypt to close down. It's going to take us at least 60 to open up.
Good question there.
I'm actually going to go back on the issue of general empowerment of people by work, you know, economically or by education, and how that actually affected their sexual behavior and attitude, and see if you guys actually noticed if there's a different attitude to sex or to or different behavior, sexual behavior, depending on the classes of people, the economic classes. And the other thing is, I knew that I'm going to be starting a note coming here because I always think it's not about sex in the Middle East. It's about actually, it's about people, it's about their power. And by power, I mean, you know, you being the power, you're feeling kind of feeling good about yourself. You have a place, you have a place in the world, you work, you actually participate. I think, you know, the problem mainly in the Arab people is if tomorrow, like, you know, hypothetically, disasters happen and wipe away the whole Middle East and North Africa, nobody's going to notice in the world because, you know, actually, obviously, I'm one of them. We don't feel like we have our place in the world. We've been defeated for so long. You know, deeply the Arabic man is a defeated man. Mm-hmm. And you know, some of them actually managed to get some empowerment through education, through work, through actually coming, you know, going, meeting people. But the others who are left behind, obviously they're not going to be able to be, you know, succeed their sexual life because they feel that, you know, there's a deep failure between them. So, yeah.
In terms of the class, and again, I'm speaking specifically of Egypt here, which is the focus of my book. Historically, there used to be quite a distinction, if you look back 50 years, to what was happening in rural areas and what was happening in urban areas and what was happening amongst poorer populations and the sort of more educated. And it is generally true that it was a much more open sexual environment and there was much more open discourse. I mean, my father talks about, you know, our family is an upper middle class family in Egypt. My father was born in the 30s. He talked about going to the village to learn about sex because people talked much more openly there, particularly the women spoke more openly. What we've seen in Egypt certainly is a compression now in terms of most attitudes, and that's in part the effect of media, the fact that in the villages, for example, in poor communities, people are being exposed to the same satellite television programs, and a lot of that has been, you know, conservative, Islamically inflected. And of course, one has also had, particularly in the case of Egypt, the migration of people from poorer strata to the Gulf, where they have also imbibed much more conservative attitudes. So generally speaking, we are starting to see a compression of attitudes, and it's very interesting that if you look at the recent national survey of young people in Egypt, which looked at 15,000 young people across all economic spectra, you basically see that attitudes are not varying very much according to wealth, interestingly, on many of these aspects of sex. And again, sex is not the only way to look at any society. The reason that we're talking about it is that it is, however, a very powerful lens through which to look at politics and economics and religion and tradition, but it's certainly not the only one.
Well, I have a gentleman there, and then the lady at the back, yeah?
Oh, there are lots of things you said. The thing is, we don't know because of private and public sphere. I also a class divide, not in the Middle East. In the Arab world, there is also big tribal divide. Tribes marry tribes, and as you described the scenario from Kuwait, the particular family rule, and also actually their marriages as well are conducted within particular lineages. Another point, you know, just behind Harrods, for example, there are people who are living in the 21st century with all the modern apparatuses, lovely Ferrari car, perhaps, you know, designer clothing and clothing. But their private sphere is pre-modern. So they haven't actually, physical appearance might be modern, but I think in their attitude, they're still somewhere in the Gulf region. I really want to talk about Britain. Up till the 80s, women had difficulty getting mortgages in this country. You know, they needed their men's signature. So it's only in the 80s. Gay rights are very recent in this country. And this is a country which has been educated for at least 100 years, more than 50% of the population. In the Middle East, there is, I mean, in Egypt, for example, 40% of the population they're below the poverty line, you know? And, of course, the class divide in Egypt is even more severe. You've got a literate, dictatorship and their family members who travel the world and have a modern lifestyle, and the masses of people have no access to any of that. So and I think to compare Western, the way we live in the West, with these pre-modern societies seems to me really problematic. The expectation we have that somehow they should break their private spheres where they may have different types of relationships to somehow come out into the open to find an acceptance in the public sphere seems to be really problematic to expect that so quickly.
I think it can actually be quite useful to make comparisons with Britain. I talked to young gay Egyptians, for example, who imagine that Britain has always been like it is now. And, you know, when you tell them that in Britain you could be executed for sodomy
yes.
as recently as 1861, they're quite surprised. And I think it's quite useful to make these comparisons because it certainly gives people hope in countries where they have these problems that things can actually change. You know, you look at Britain, probably, I think 1948 to 1968 was a very kind of important period in Britain because basically we had a huge social revolution, which really isn't kind of recognised as a revolution, but there were some enormous social changes then. And when you say that this happened, then you can consider the possibility that something similar might happen in parts of the Middle East as well.
And I wanted to argue the difference between urban south, for example, London.
Oh, yeah.
Going in the middle. I remember when it was called NCCL, which is called Liberty Yard, right? I was sitting in a meeting with the coal miners who'd come from up north. And they were seeing all these, you know, smart looking women. And they were referring to that woman as a lovely looking woman, you know. And she made a very good point. And these women were completely aghast. This is, I'm talking the 80s, for God's sake.
Yeah.
So please do not regard the Middle East somehow as...
I have a slightly different perspective than Brian. And in my book, I never make reference to the West because I actually think that different societies take different paths. And particularly if you look across the Global South now, the Arab world, not unique in its sexual hang-ups. You can look across the East and West and find a spectrum of problems. But again, the vision of the West that the sexual revolution was like this helicopter which took off from a terrain of taboo to a free air of sexual liberty is simply not the case. It is more like one of these C-130 Hercules transporters that needs a really long runway. And that runway was built over hundreds of years of political, economic, and social change in the West until it took off. Okay, in the Arab region, you can argue, like, do we have a plane? But we definitely don't have a runway. We haven't built that yet. And even when we do, I'm not sure that we're going to be taking off into the same direction. And time again, the groups I talked with, the activists who were trying to get sexuality education into schools, trying to find a space for unwed mothers, trying to help people in their sexual lives, they all, to a man and woman, said, look, we know what happened in the West. We know that history. And we are choosing to do things differently. Not because we are ignorant, because we have that information, and we are just different. We're not better, we're not worse, we're just different. And so that's why I think the analogies don't necessarily fit from East and West.
Yep.
I have a question about divorce rates and how they divorce rates in the Middle East. My grandparents' generation, they would marry extremely young and they would go into that marriage expecting to stay with that person for the rest of their lives. And my grandmother got married at 16. And divorce is extremely rare. I don't think anyone would really divorce them.
Where are you from?
Korea.
Okay.
And now in my generation, I think something crazy like 1 out of 5 marriages ends in divorce within 5 years. My parents like to do that because they've lived sex lives before getting married, and so they've been disillusioned when they do get married. They have much higher expectations, and that's why marrying is a lot. It's disappointing in a sense. But I think, like you guys were saying during the talk, having broader perspectives and having more open minds is a good thing. Why is it then that there's such higher
Just on the subject of divorce rates, so yes, there is. It is quite interesting that in the Gulf states the divorce rate is quite high, and it is rising. But very often the reason that is cited in official studies, and these are happening galore now because there is a national panic about people not being inside the citadel. They're largely arguing actually it's because of a lack of sexual experience before marriage. The people have inflated expectations and very poor communication skills, and it all comes apart. What's interesting in Egypt, though, is that the divorce rate is actually lower now than it was in my parents' or in my grandparents' day. The number of divorces is actually declining, interestingly, in Egypt. And one of the reasons for that, and it explains the distinction to the Gulf states, is economics. I mean, in Egypt, for example, you can't afford to fall out of marriage officially because you have to pay. And particularly for men who can't afford to move out of the matrimonial home, can't afford to pay alimony. So it's in large part economics that's driving divorce. But it's true that divorce remains highly stigmatizing for many women. And in Egypt, for example, most divorced women, they have, that I know in particular, have to move back with their families. They can't live on their own.
Daniel?
Yeah, I just wanted to, in fact, to pick up on a point that you made in the gentleman over there. When I was at school, which isn't that long ago, I didn't know a single person in my class whose parents were divorced. I went to a Catholic school, and a divorced teacher was kicked out. So
it was certainly quite shocking.
Indeed, so. So I think that when we talk about the change, in fact, the change in this country. And if you go to other European countries, for instance, in Mediterranean countries, the change is even more recent. Places like Italy and Spain, you find that the change only happened sort of 10 years after it happened in this country. But so when it comes to divorce, it was exactly the same situation. And I think there is another very good reason why the higher divorce rate is that people can divorce. Yes, it is stigmatized, but not as much as it used to be, and they are able to get on. It is no longer as exceptional as it once was.
Yeah, go on.
It could be a very stupid and silly question, but I just want to know the message.
Speak up.
Your message from your book, and in your opinion, I want to know your view that is the Arabic women have talk about sex and be more open, if that can help our Middle East, it can reduce the divorce,
Again, nothing. You can't really say very much empirically about what is the solution, because we don't really know in a robust fashion what are the problems. We don't have a Kinsey report for the Arab region, so we don't actually know what's happening in sexual lives beyond things like sexual violence, for example, or FGM. We know a lot about the problems. We don't know so much about what's happening in everyday sexual lives. But the essence of my book is, the take-home message is basically this. Look, we have three red lines in the Arab region. These are the subjects we're not supposed to challenge. One is politics. And since 2011, that line has been well and truly crossed. The second line is religion. But certainly with the rise and subsequent fall of groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, people are starting to ask tough questions about, for example, the role of Islam in our constitutions, in our public sphere. And that third red line is sex. And the message of my book is start asking the questions in the emerging freedom of expression that many people are grappling for. Start asking these hard questions about why things are the way they are. Do they have to be this way? Because if you ask these questions, and if we try to anchor freedom and justice and dignity and equality in our private lives, in our sexual lives, it will have an impact. In our public life, in our political life, because the personal and the political are intertwined, and that's not just true in the Arab region, that's wherever you live.
I think it's happening.
No, I think it's happening, but also I just wanted to say is that I think that women in the Arab world are talking to each other. I think that they are very forthright across the region, and I think maybe among themselves that they are, but it's to bring those private discussions maybe more into the public sphere, or at least among men and women. But that's what I've noticed in my research, is that the women are very forthright, and they are very much willing to talk.
More than the men. Much
more than the men.
almost all the pioneers I talk about in the book, all these people who were trying to find solutions to these problems, they're almost entirely women.
Okay, last three, I think. Yeah.
What about the internet? Like, we talk about the internet as being a succession of satellites of the gender, as being, you know, uniformization of the image of sexual relationships, how people behave with each other. Whereas actually, the internet is quite an emancipating tool. In fact, if you go to like all the social forums, etc., this is where one of the only places where you have communication between men and women. They can actually share their views. Whereas, well, as you said, women talk to each other, men to talk to each other on a social level, right, in their daily interaction. But behind those keyboards, people actually tell what they think and are able to share their views. And my second point is, I was just going to refer to like the dichotomy between what's happening in big cities and the smaller cities. And that happened in Morocco when we had the two teenagers kissing in Nador, right? That was crazy. People were getting mad about it.
Do you want to explain, just can you give people here who don't know the background?
What happened is that you had two teenagers in a small city in Morocco kissing each other and created a whole mess.
And they were arrested.
Yeah, they were arrested, you know.
And a man attacked them who was from the government.
It was actually a human rights activist who reported them, which is quite ironic.
but
the thing is, like, in Rabat and Casablanca, which are the big cities, like, no one cares about them. If a guy is with his girlfriend or kissing that woman or whatever, and, you know, in a smaller city where things are, you know, more conservative, and it's not about religion, it's more about, you know,
social
habits being deeply rooted in people's mindset. I think that's probably the main issue in the Arab world. It's just,
I'll just take the questions and then.
Through my fieldwork recently in Egypt, I was interviewing lots of men and women who were the 1 year of the Muslim Brotherhood government. And what I found was a lot of them reacted sort of quite negatively towards it. They felt like Muslim Brotherhood were trying to sort of impose their brand of Islam in their homes, in sort of each household individually. And it got me thinking about Nasser in the 50s and 60s, who, although he opened up the economy for women greatly and gave them the vote in 56 and whatnot, he was always very reluctant to interfere in the home. In fact, and quite generally on YouTube, the very famous video between Nasser and the Murshid of the Muslim Brotherhood in 1954, where he makes a sort of joke about the Muslim Brotherhood by saying they want me to put the veil on 10 million women Egyptian, and I can't even put the veil on my own kids. So this idea that Nasser was very aware not to interfere in the home, which one could argue was the mistake perhaps the Muslim Brotherhood tried to do, or perhaps tried to do too soon. My question is, why is this? Why was Nasser so aware, and why was Morsi so wrong trying to interfere in the home of every family? Why did this disconnect between the state and the family?
There was one over here. Yep.
If you had the resources to help you set up a project in Egypt specifically, what would you do to get women off the ground?
Okay.
Should we?
Yeah.
Just go around.
I'll do very quickly the three of them. On the internet, I mean, as anywhere in the world, both a boon and a bane. So, I mean, Brian can talk, for example, about the power of the internet for young people in particular who cross the heterosexual line, who may or may not self-identify as LGBT. It can be this hugely empowering experience, particularly for women, in terms of connecting with women with similar desires. The internet can also be problematic, and in particular as a vehicle for pornography. And I talk in my book about FGM, female genital mutilation. And in many of the cases that we looked at, men didn't used to know whether their wives were circumcised or not. They sort of assumed they were, because there's so little sexual education, they don't really know what's going on down there. But now they can watch porn on the internet. And now they have views about FGM, because one of the rationales for FGM is that you clip the clitoris in order to control a woman's sexual desire, a perennial concern for Arab men. But they say, hey, we saw these women on the internet. They're having, these Western women, they're not circumcised. They're having sex with 2-3 men at a time. We told you, we need to circumcise our girls, because this is what happens. So it, as in any case, it has both benefits and detrimental consequences. In the case of Morocco, definitely what we are seeing, however, in the social context is a bit of slacktivism, basically. So you know there was this Facebook page in which thousands of young Moroccans came in and said, yes, definitely, it's wrong that these people are arrested. And yet when they tried to take that out onto the streets in a kiss-in, only about 20 people showed up. So, again, the internet and these new media, incredibly powerful in a political context, but it's going to take time to shift attitudes in a social context. To the young man about Nasser and Morsi, it's not just in private life one can compare the relative political abilities. I think maybe that's something that we can, it's such a complex question, we'll address it outside. What I would do is I would start talking to men. Because we have left men behind. We see them as pillars of the patriarchy. They're the cause of disease and exploitation and dysfunction. We know so little about what men really want inside the bedroom and outside. And we need to start working with them specifically. I can count on one hand the number of NGOs across the Arab region that actually deal with men in terms of social life and their family lives. And that's the one thing I would do, start working with young men.
So there's a second book.
Watch this.
Any thoughts? Well, I was just thinking when you were talking about the internet, I was thinking about America and television and how in the 50s and 60s they would say, that, well, I was reading research on that, that people would, they would identify with what they saw on television, the ideal family life, you know, they would learn from television. So I think that the internet, I agree, that it's very powerful. And it also has its problems. We have to see where it will go. I guess the thing about me really is that I sort of feel uncomfortable when you're talking about comparisons between the Middle East and the West. I really sort of, it makes me nervous because I don't like, I'm not really interested in, and it's more my work with visual culture or my work with Syrian lingerie was really to unpeel and see what people thought about their sex lives or how they wanted to use sexy lingerie and how it sort of became popularized. And that's really, I think that now in terms of the visual culture coming out of the Middle East, that you can see, you can learn things about these countries and you can see the complexities that people there face. And I think that's something that's universal all over.
With regards to the, so although there's one point, talk about female genital mutilation, which incidentally is never mentioned in any of the ecological manuals.
Wow.
No, it's never mentioned. But what is mentioned, and it is quite striking that, and this is a little known fact, the Arabs discovered the clitoris.
Adam.
Well, yes. Well, Arab men. Women knew about it before, one would imagine. They discovered the function of the clitoris when talking about lesbian sex. And so they explained it, or at least there's one particular one from the 12th century, explaining the friction of this bit, which he refers to as an upturned furuncle. So an upturned blister, he doesn't have a name for it at the time. But anyway, as for the internet and the thing about learning about one's past, it is very interesting that a number of these classical manuals, including some manuscripts, can actually be found on the internet. And so, whereas often it's difficult, almost impossible to find them in bookshops, and if you do ask, you've got to whisper and go to another room lest you offend some people in the shop. So one presumes that people are reading that. Whether or not they're reading it for a particular reason, as in discovering one's heritage or for titillation, is another point. But so the internet, indeed, I think in this case, is a boon, definitely for people who want to read those books. I'll give you titles after if you're interested.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, I do think the internet is hugely important. I mean, you look at what's available here in terms of sex education, things like that, in bookshops, for example. And there's nothing really comparable in the Arab countries. And so the internet is where lots of people now get information that they didn't have access to before. It also has a social function where people can make contacts over the internet that they didn't make before. I'm a bit reluctant to this as kind of sub-argument that develops about making comparisons between the West and the Arab countries. I mean, I do think, certainly from what I've studied about gay issues in the Middle East, that there are a lot, enormous number of parallels between what has happened here in the past and what happens there now. And one example that somebody gave me was they did a study of gay sexual activity in the back of a cinema in Damascus. And they wrote an academic paper on it. And when I read it, I found something which was almost exactly the same talking about cinemas in London in the 1950s. So there are, you know, obviously there are differences, but also there are a huge number of similarities as well. Shall we stop there? Thank you all very much.